Hello and welcome to the latest episode of our Psoriatic Arthritis podcast series. We're bringing you new episodes monthly alongside Rheumatoid Arthritis and AxSpA podcasts, and we'll be supplying you with monthly slide decks to help keep you up to date with the latest research and publications in the field of PSA. My name is Peter Nash, Professor at the School of Medicine, Griffith University, beautiful downtown Brisbane, in Queensland, Australia, and joining me today, we're very lucky to have Philip Meese, a professor at the University of Washington School of Medicine and Director of Rheumatology Research at the Swedish Medical Center in Seattle, as well as Professor Laura Coates, who's an associate professor at the University of Oxford's Nuffield Department of Orthopaedics, Rheumatology and Musculoskeletal Sciences. And lastly, we're joined by Professor Frank Behrens, who's a professor of translational rheumatology, immunology, and inflammation medicine at the Goethe University and deputy director of the Fraunhofer Institute for Translational Medicine and Pharmacology in Frankfurt in Germany. So today we're going to discuss two papers, one from Arthritis Research and Therapy and another one from RMD Open. Both of them will be available for you later. In full text as well as slides. We're going to discuss long-term safety of the IL-17 inhibitor ixekizumab as well as bimekizumab in a difficult patient population to treat, the TNF inadequate responder or intolerant population. So let's look at the first paper. Philip, would you tell us about the first paper, please?
Certainly. So this is entitled Long-Term Safety of Ixekizumab in Adults with Psoriasis, Psoriatic Arthritis, or Axial Spondyloarthritis, a post-hoc analysis of final safety data from 25 randomized clinical trials. This was lead authored by our fellow steering committee member, Professor Atul Deodar. Background of the study, these are reports on inflammatory diseases such as psoriasis, psoriatic arthritis, and AxSpA, and we know that they require prolonged treatment for optimal management, for achievement of goals like low disease activity or remission. But it's important when we're doing these long-term observational studies to look at safety. So this is looking at all 25 randomized clinical trials and the thousands of patients in those. Ixekizumab, as you know, is an IL-17A inhibitor that has previously undergone long-term safety analysis and subsequent long-term exposure for efficacy. This particular analysis is end of study of each of the 25 studies. In adult patients with psoriasis who've had up to 6 years of exposure to the drug, and PSA and AxSpA patients who've had up to 3 years of exposure to the drug. So we're looking at 17 psoriasis trials, 4 in PSA and 4 in axial spondyloarthritis. The rates of treatment emergent adverse events, or TEAEs, serious adverse events, and selected adverse events of interest were analyzed for all pooled studies by years of therapy and overall through March 2022. The results were reported as exposure-adjusted incidence rates, or EAIRs, per 100 patient years overall and at successive year intervals. What were the results? So a total of 6,892 adult patients with psoriasis, 1,401 patients with PSA, and 932 with AxSpA, including both radiographic axial SpA or ankylosing spondylitis, as well as non-radiographic axial SpA. With a cumulative ixekizumab exposure of 22,371 patient years. So this is a lot of patient data that we're looking at. The most commonly reported TEAEs across the indications was nasopharyngitis, so routine colds. The incidence rates per 100 patient years were about 9 events per 100 patient years in each of the disease states. Serious adverse events were reported by 969 patients with psoriasis, 134 with PSA, and 101 with axSpA, for a incident rate of about six, a little bit less than that, with each of the diseases. 45 deaths were reported. Now, these might not have been related to ixekizumab at all. They could have been routine deaths, like for myocardial infarction. The incidence rate for psoriasis was 0.2 events per 100 patient years, for PSA 0.3, and for axSpA was 0.1. When we looked at TEAE exposure over time, we see that overall the rate reduced with time. So in the years 0 to 1, for example, with psoriasis, there were 88.9 TEAEs, and this went down to 63.2 reported in the year 4 to 5. And there were similar rates and reductions seen in the other disease states as well. In terms of discontinuation from study, 2.9 events per 100 patient years for psoriasis, 5.1 for PSA, and 3.1 for axSpA. Now let's get on to some of the events that were of special interest. For example, let's start with injection site reactions. And this, remember, was mostly before we had the new formulation of ixekizumab that has less in the way of injection site reactions. So the events were 5.9 per 100 patient years for psoriasis, 11.6 for psoriatic arthritis, and 7.4 for axSpA. Candida. We know that interleukin-17 as a cytokine is important for protection against surface candida. There were 1.9 events per 100 patient years for psoriasis, 2.0 for psoriatic arthritis, and 1.2 for axSpA. And these were mostly mild and were easily treated with topical agents and did not, for the most part, lead to discontinuation of drug. Another important one in a psoriasis or psoriatic arthritis or axSpA population is comorbidity of depression. And also, we want to know about major adverse cardiovascular events as well as malignancies. These were all less than or equal to 1.6 across all the indications. And in particular, in relation to malignancy, there was no specific kind of malignancy to point to. The adjudicated rates of inflammatory bowel disease are of particular interest because IL-17, again, appears to help protect the gut, and there is a potential with IL-17 inhibition to have either a flare of known IBD or new onset IBD. So these rates were 0.1 for psoriasis, 0.1 events per 100 patient years for PSA, and slightly more, 0.8, for axSpA, where we know there's slightly greater association for IBD naturally. So in conclusion, patients mostly experience mild or moderate treatment emergent adverse events, consistent with what we have known about ixekizumab safety over the years. The incident rates of TEAEs did not increase when adjusted for exposure, and the safety signals remained stable throughout prolonged ixekizumab treatment periods. And these data thus provide a valuable point of reference for long-term ixekizumab treatment safety in clinical practice.
So thank you, Phil. I was going to ask Frank, when you look at the discontinuation rates, the PSA patients always seem to be double the other indications, even though it's very low. It's still 5 in 100 per year compared to 3. Why does PSA patients churn so much? Lots of studies now show that the retention over at year end is not as high as we'd expect. Is it because we have so much choice, or because there's a lot of nociceptive neuropathic type pain in our patients, and they're very disgruntled and they change drugs frequently?
Yeah, I think there are two, both options have some impact on the discontinuation rate. I think one is, of course, we have a lot of different treatment options with different mode of actions. And maybe therefore there's a trend to move forward in case that you are unhappy with how you control the disease. On the other hand, I wouldn't believe that the specific centralization of pain is different in PsA compared to RA. The only aspect may be that the part of substratic disease which focusing on the entesial compartment, sometimes it's challenging with a mixture of fibromyalgia kind of pain and the real enthesitis, and maybe this might drive in some cases them to switch from one or the other mode of action. That's my explanation on this. But I think the main one is the persistent on the options we have right now to move forward to a more specific, to a different mode of action, et cetera, and to optimize outcome.
We're
And Laura,
treating one disease, aren't we? We're treating
yeah,
psoriasis and
you're right.
arthritis, maybe IBD as well. And so I think there's often cases where maybe their joints have got better, but their skin hasn't quite settled, or their skin has got better and their joints haven't settled, or their IBD is flaring, and you need to change treatment. So I think that does complicate things as well.
So
I
Philip, I have a question with respect to the methodology to mix up different indications in a pooled safety analysis. So in the past, we have always learned also from the authorities that you have very properly figure out safety profiles in the exact patient population you want to treat. And now we're mixing up different indications. Maybe is this due to the fact that the safety signals are so rare? And we want to combine it to increase the numbers. This was first question. And the second question is, I think, Laura, you presented it. It was ACR. It's a combined Guselkumab data with, I think, 20 trials, or I don't know, also with a huge number of data and patient years. First question, so what about methodological aspects with combining different diseases? And the other point is, if you reflect this paper on the background, what was presented by Laura during ACR with Guselkumab?
So the first comment I would make is that in many ways, this isn't really pooling because they're reporting each of these particular outcomes based on the disease. So psoriasis separate from psoriatic arthritis, separate from axSpA. So I think it's more
An overview.
efficiency and economy of getting information across to do it in one paper as opposed to splitting it into three papers. I also think it's kind of interesting to be able to look across disease states. So, for example, the fact that there's a little bit more IBD in axSpA than in psoriasis or PsA kind of fits with what we know about those diseases and the risk for that particular associated condition. This isn't like, you know, some of the adalimumab safety reports that we saw back when we saw like seven or eight disease states and being reported, but they were all reported separately. So I think that's fair. And I want to make one comment. Peter, I know that you pointed out the discontinuation rate being a little bit higher for PsA, but when you think about it, these are incredibly low rates of discontinuation.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. And so I think it kind of, for me, it kind of interesting that people seem to be satisfied, or else they were just good soldiers. Doing these studies.
Well, I like the idea of good soldiers, because I think that's quite reasonable. I was going to ask you, Laura, about the IBD, how you handle it, and I like the way that it fits with what I've been telling patients: 1 in 1,000 per year for PsA, and 7 or 8 per 1,000 per year for axSpA. How do you manage that IBD issue? Because the competition sure make a big noise about IBD and the 17 inhibitors.
And obviously it is relevant, and as we said at the beginning, we've got lots of choices for PsA, and this is obviously one of the things that's going to come into that decision. I mean, I think there's, in all of these studies now and in all of the registry data, there's going to be some pre-selection of patients. So patients who have IBD or who have symptoms that maybe sound a bit like IBD, are probably less likely to get IL-17. So there is going to be a channeling bias coming into these trials and registry reports for IL-17. But obviously it is reassuring that in a group that presumably didn't have much in the way of bowel symptoms, most likely, who then were treated with an IL-17, that the risk is still pretty low. And obviously, you know, if somebody has active IBD, there are other better choices than an IL-17. And we're seeing new options come through as well with licensing for UC and for Crohn's. So we've got increasing numbers of options, but I think it's really useful to know that in patients who we're not worried about IBD, actually the risk is indeed low. We can sort of reassure patients about that, and we still have these as a good option for treating psoriasis and PSA.
So Phil, one of the commonest questions is, why should we screen everybody with fecal calprotectins and in the absence of symptoms? So do you do any screening other than asking the patient a couple of questions?
So the true answer is no. I don't know that I really know well how to handle the result of a fecal calprotectin unless it's really high. I tend to defer to my GI colleagues who are literally right down the hall from me and do a great job of asking questions and screening. So I mainly just ask questions. I do ask about family history. And if anything shows up that along the lines of what Laura was just commenting on about GI symptomatology, then I'll get them to make a quick pit stop by the GI office.
What about you, Frank?
I have the privilege in my inflammation clinic that the gastroenterologist and the dermatologist is joining my clinic. And therefore, they, of course, asking me that fecal calprotectin should be done in every patient with some kind of symptoms of diarrhea once a month, which nearly everyone had. I think that's a challenge. So, but they definitely insist that if you have a negative and normal within the normal range calprotectin, then you are safe. So they don't do any further diagnostic procedure in case it's negative. So it kind of for being safe and sure that everything runs smoothly, then maybe you can do it. That's why doing what we are doing here in our inflammation clinic, again, with the privilege to have a gastroenterologist at the same clinic. But my question is, in the past, patients were allowed to go into trials if it's a controlled and inactive disease for many years. That's for me a question. So my question is the incidence of IBD in AXL SpA due to the higher overall incidence in this disease, or during the fact that we, based on the limited options we have, we tend to go for an IL-17 if you fail a TNF, because we don't have the option to go for an IL-23 or whatever. So what's your opinion on it? Is it only due to the natural incidence higher in AXL SpA, or because we are more pushed forward to do an IL-17 because we only have to check the TNFs, that's it?
It's a reasonable question, but my gut instinct is based on epidemiology of the associated condition, that it's a genetically driven phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
Or,
I'm with you.
Or a microbiome as well, yeah. Driven phenomenon.
It's interesting, we're taught under 50 calprotectin rules out inflammatory bowel disease, over 150 you investigate, and it's quite a high positive and negative predictive value for both of those things, rule in, rule out. So that's helpful. But what we don't have in any of these papers, which reflects their absence, is serious infection. We don't get serious infection, opportunist infection, TB reactivation. It's not even listed, Philip, in the 22,000 patient years of exposure, which I think is very different to the TNFs.
Yes, very much so. Both with this mechanism as well as the IL-23 inhibition mechanism, we're just not seeing those serious infection issues in the same way. So I think that's been a real plus.
I think the safety is remarkable and allows us to think combination. So let's move on to our second paper. Laura, would you mind?
Sure. So another IL-17. So this is called bimekizumab treatment in patients with active PSA and prior inadequate response to TNF inhibitors, a 52-week safety and efficacy data from the phase 3B complete study and its open label extension B vital, for which most of us on the call were authors. So obviously this is looking at data in TNF failures in TNF inadequate responders. And we know that for most patients in rheumatology, TNF is typically used as a first line. And therefore, the efficacy and safety, particularly in patients who are TNF failures, is really key when we're thinking about where we use new medications and how we bring other mode of actions into the clinic. So when they developed the studies for bimekizumab in phase 3, there was the B optimal study in biologic naive patients and the B complete study, which looked at bimekizumab in TNF-IR patients. Then both of those patients after those initial studies went into an open label extension B vital. So that kind of pooled the patients together. But in this analysis, they're particularly looking at the TNF failures. And obviously, this is important. We know if somebody's had an inadequate response to TNF, that they are less likely to achieve good outcomes with subsequent lines of therapy. We know that that happens to, unfortunately, a lot of people, that we do see cycling and switching of medications. And so having a therapy that works in that group is really important. So in the study, the patients received 160 milligrams of bimekizumab every 4 weeks, and they followed them out to week 52 in this study. So they had quite a high completion rate, good soldiers. So 347 of the 400 patients completed out to week 52. And similar to the data you've just heard, the adverse event rate was very low, 126 adverse events per 100 patient years, and that was only 7 for serious treatment emergent adverse events. The most frequent adverse events that they saw were a COVID-19 infection, that obviously reflects the time that the study was running, oral candidiasis, as you'd expect with an IL-17, nasopharyngitis, and urinary tract infections, which obviously are common across most conditions. All of the fungal infections that they had were mild or moderate and were localized. And just 2 of the patients who had candidiasis discontinued the study because of that. Similar to what we've just discussed, there were no cases of active TB in this group. There were also no cases of uveitis and no cases of inflammatory bowel disease that were reported. There was one sudden death in that year follow-up. And that was a patient who was 54 with quite a significant cardiac history, so hypertension, aortic regurgitation, and coronary artery disease. And there's no further information about exactly what happened to that patient. In terms of efficacy as well as safety, we saw sustained efficacy with bimekizumab from week 16, that was the end of the placebo control portion, out to week 52. And that was with both clinically assessed outcomes and patient reported outcomes. So the primary outcome for these studies was ACR50. When you look at the ACR50 responses, 51% of patients who were randomized to bimekizumab hit ACR50 by week 52. And if you look at those ones who were initially on placebo, who then switched to bimekizumab at week 16, 40% of those also achieved ACR50. PASI 100, as you'd expect, with an IL-17A and F blocker was very high. So PASI 100 seen in 66% of people on bimekizumab and 60% of people who were initially on placebo and switched to bimekizumab. And then minimal disease activity achieved by 47% of those initially on bimekizumab and 33% initially on placebo and then switched. So it's clear from this data that bimekizumab was generally very well tolerated in patients who were TNF-IR PSA population out to week 52. And the safety profile looked very consistent with the IL-17s in general and with bimekizumab from previous studies. They did obviously see a slightly higher rate of treatment emergent adverse events and AEs of interest with drug compared to placebo, but overall the rates were quite low. And the candida infections seemed quite similar in the initial placebo control period up to week 16 and out to week 52, suggesting, similar to the previous paper, that there's no real change in incidence over time. So an increasing exposure is not putting people at a higher risk of candida. And the clinical outcomes also looked good. So bimekizumab was associated with superior efficacy to placebo in treating PSA across a number of different domains, in arthritis, in skin disease, and in overall disease control, and as well as seeing the sort of rapid improvements that we see early on in the course of the study at week 16 compared to placebo, and then once those patients on placebo switch to bimekizumab, and those good outcomes seem to be well sustained out to week 52 in the study.
So, Frank, pretty impressive results. You're getting 66% PASI 100, 47% MDA, and 50-odd percent ACR 50. The argument's always, is blocking F and A superior to A alone? And this is a very difficult patient population, the TNFIR groups. So what do you think? Is this the first solid data that convinces you blocking F might have an advantage over A alone?
Yeah. So I think it was remarkable, at least, that the EULAR decided in the discussion during the last meeting that the IL-17A and F inhibition comes to in a different basket based on the mode of action compared to the pure IL-17A inhibitors. And you can now discuss while IL-23, IL-12 inhibition is the same basket like P19 IL-23. So this is indicating that there's a at least relevant or biologic reasonable differences in the mode of action between the pure IL-17A inhibition. So I think there is a lot of ex vivo and in vitro data. And the most interesting ones may be that if you stimulate PBMCs, that at the beginning the inflammatory signal is answered by IL-17A, and if you increase the time of stimulation, then A goes down and F comes up, despite the fact that the potent of A is much higher than of F. Is this a good reason to believe that maybe at least for persistence over time, maybe bimekizumab is based on the mode of action superior? I don't know. I think there is a lot of stories built up for reasons to believe that this difference in mode of action might have an impact. You're absolutely right. It is remarkable that the responses to bimekizumab is not different in those who failed TNF versus those who were naive. But if I remember correctly, this was comparable to tofacitinib in the past in the aura broaden and the aura beyond. I think there was also not a huge difference. So I think it's an interesting molecule anyway. I think the in vitro data are really interesting also in comparison, also in the combination of the inflammatory signal by combining TNF and IL-17, combining IL-17A and F, and we have learned, and this is what I really believe, that both A and F are independent triggers for inflammation also in co-incubation with TNF. Whether this will result in superiority, this has to be demonstrated in a head-to-head trial. That's what we have to do. And the question is the superiority in the overall responses at week 12, 24, whatever, or maybe superiority in the persistence over time and or in different specific domains only, which are difficult to treat, maybe in enthesitis, maybe in other things. And this has to be demonstrated in superiority trials. And I think the company is definitely thinking about it to look whether they can demonstrate, because we discuss a lot on the in vitro data and all the replies from doctors is always show us in clinic if you really believe in it. And then we have to wait for it.
Let's ask sort of the same question. Blocking F superior to A alone. and without a safety penalty by the look of it, without significantly more candida or significantly more IBD. What do you think, Laura?
Yeah, I think it is really difficult. As Frank said, the data from the basic science studies was really compelling, and that came out ahead of the clinical trials and looked very good. But we don't have that head-to-head data. I think in skin, you've got better head-to-head data. You've got across most drugs, but also specifically for bimekizumab, and that's very helpful. I think in the higher dose, maybe a little bit more candida seen with the higher dose bimekizumab in the psoriasis studies. So that there is maybe a little bit of a safety penalty, but not particularly in this study at the 160 milligram dose. But I think this is a really big question. It's a question we've been grappling with in our hospital currently, because for us, bimekizumab is slightly cheaper than secukinumab, having just come new to market. But obviously in a couple of years, potentially secukinumab will come off patent and we will have biosimilars. So do we use bimekizumab as our treatment of choice because it might be better and because currently it's slightly cheaper? Or do we stick with secukinumab, which has traditionally been the most commonly used IL-17 in our trust, because it may come off patent in the future and then be cheaper? And we can argue for using more efficacious drugs or safer drugs, even if they are more expensive, but we need that data. We need to know that they are superior and where they're superior to drive that change.
So, Philip, the same question. Our derms are switching a lot to BIMI because of this kind of data and the PSO data itself. How do you see the A versus AF argument?
Right. I go back to the same comments that were made earlier about the translational data that preceded these clinical trials. There's a prominent study that we've been shown that shows us that when synoviocytes are stimulated and then given inhibition by IL-17A alone, F alone, or A and F, we know that there's more reduction of pro-inflammatory gene expression when you do the A and F. So there's some translational support there. I'm looking at these MDA rates. They're high. And they're higher than what we've seen typically than with the IL-17A agents. But I also echo the point that we really need to see head-to-head, because what happens in head-to-head trials is that everybody seems to do better than they did in their control trial data. But one of the questions I'd like to direct, if you don't mind, to Laura, is the MDA rate was, what, 47% in the original BIMI group at 52 weeks, 33% in the group that went from placebo to BIMI. Yeah, I know it's just speculation on your part, but do you think that eventually that latter group will catch up? Or do you think there's something about getting started later that is an issue here?
Yes, I think that's really interesting. And we saw that across multiple outcome measures, that the placebo group hadn't quite caught up at week 52. And that's despite switching drug at week 16. So they've had sort of, you know, 9 months on drug. They've had a good amount of time where you would expect it maybe to have plateaued and reached its best outcome. And we haven't really seen that in the PASI, in the ACR, and in the MDA. It does seem to be a little bit lower. I think I would be more convinced if these were early patients. If we were delaying initial treatment for these patients, then I would say, yeah, maybe that's having a longer term impact. But these are already TNFIR patients, so they've been around the block a bit. They've probably had conventional DMARDs and TNFs before they've entered the trial and have more established disease anyway. So I would have thought that would be less relevant. But it is interesting in quite a number of studies, even if you go back to some of the older adalimumab studies, at year one, at year two, even out to year three, you can see a bit of a difference between the placebo and the active treatment initial patients. So I think there is an issue here with us treating people with placebo for 4 months. That's not something that we do in clinical practice. Whether that causes much radiographic damage, obviously for most patients it doesn't, but what that's doing to your immunology, to the persistence of disease, and to the level of pain and impact that that patient feels is significant, I think. And I think as we have more and more treatment options, it's something that ideally, with the support of regulators, we would move away from. It would be far more helpful for us to have an initial study that compared, you know, new exciting drug A against adalimumab as a standard of care, or against an IL-17 as a standard of care, rather than a placebo-controlled trial. Then we don't have to ask for head-to-head studies because they get done anyway. And we shouldn't be using placebos. It's not really ethical given the number of drugs and the options we have available.
So let's talk about that. So we've got 3 17s. Frank, you presented a fourth 17. There's a couple more out there. How many 17 inhibitors do we need, Frank?
Peter, you're slightly older than I. I had to ask
very you slightly, very slightly.
Yeah. I had to ask you this question many years ago. How many anti-TNFs do we need in rheumatoid arthritis? I have no idea. Though we have a lot of anti-TNFs originators in RA, and of course you are discussing with the new nanobody molecules and all these things. I'm happy, so let's do it. So maybe we can squeeze out superiority in one of specific domains, in one of specific difficult to treat patient population, and we want to have different products, and we want to figure out the advantages and disadvantages of one versus the other. That's fine for me, to be honest. So homing in tissue is an issue. Persistence of response over time is an issue. Impact in vaccination is an issue, and all these things. And I think we can always do better. And we have a very important discussion in Germany, and everybody is asking for the huge step forward with a new treatment. And I say always the same. If you look to HIV, there wasn't any disruptive evolution of treatment in HIV, but now with small steps forward and forward and forward, now you have a very well-controlled disease. And this is an example why it is a definite need to do product, despite the fact that this is not a disruptive change overall.
Okay, thank you very much, everybody. So thank you for joining us for this PSA podcast brought to you by the Immune-Mediated Inflammatory Disease Forum. We really hope you enjoyed it and found it useful. If you did, don't forget to subscribe to our channels on YouTube, Spotify, SoundCloud, and wherever you get your podcasts from, so that you don't miss any future episodes. If you want to read more about what we've discussed today, head over to imid.com, where you'll find detailed summary slides of each of the papers. And we look forward to our podcast in a month's time. So thank you, everybody, for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.